But anyway, she elected to take the lump sum. Well, I heard a year later that she'd went through that, and they had about 5 or 6 kids. She'd went through the money.
Yeah. You'd mentioned, Alan, I guess you had, well, the first helicopter that we used, you talked about on the phone there. Give me some background on, like, when you got that, what it was.
I bought that in 1958. It was a Bell 47G2. It had a 260 horse Lycoming engine in it, but it wasn't supercharged. So it was pretty weak when you got up to altitude. You know, the density altitude, but it was the first one in the whole area in eastern Oregon. And so, of course, that was new. Another thing that was really new to them, and I used it quite a bit for agriculture work, spraying and dusting with it, and then on fire work. But there was another story where they had to get used to it and or learn about it and know how to use it and so on. And the first was that, well, it just costs too much an hour for what you can do with it. And one time, I'd had it about, I guess, the first fire season. And there was 2 fires up, and this was south of Baker, too. One of them was BLM, and over a ways was a Forest Service had one. And they were both in the mop-up stage. So I was up there with the BLM had called me. And that's no contracts in those days or anything. If you were available and they needed you, you'd come. Why, that's it. And so I was over there hauling the guys up on this hillside doing these tufts of sagebrush and juniper and stuff like that that was still smoking and burning, and set one out and it wouldn't land. I just put the skid against the hillside and let the guy out, you know, then take the other one up to another place, and they seen what was going on over there. So that evening I got a call, we want you up here in the morning at daylight. And I said, well, I'm working for the BLM, they want me in the morning. You'll have to, you guys get together and you'll have to decide who needs me the worst. Because I said, otherwise I'm going back to the BLM. I said, so they kind of seen the light there then, that there was a use for that, and started using it more and more and more, and then it just comes a big demand for it, you know.
Remember what that was running per hour at that time?
I believe I was charging $160 for that at that time. But see, your insurance on them things was, back then, was a really a big, big item. And the cost of the machine was, I think, $44,000. And those 2 big items. Then if you hired a pilot, he wanted to another $20 an hour too. See, I tried to fly myself, but a lot of times I couldn't. But it was, we convinced them that there was a place for the helicopters used on forest fires, and now they really use them now. Mm-hmm. They use the big Bertols that they log with the buckets on them. Packs about 800 gallons, and they use them a lot now, especially down in California in that area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in that brush country, you get all over the place. Mm-hmm. Easy access.
Yeah.
But even on the forest, I remember we used to, you know, just cut a little spot out, and when Bill was in there with those bells and the, like that, he could, you know, he's of course knew the country too, but we'd get him in and bring people in, haul stuff out. I know some of the other pilots that came in, they were real spooked at it because there'd just be a little hole here sitting up on top of the ridge, something like
that. Yeah, the Bell and the Hiller, that was the two that was the popular ones. Well, I think that's about the only ones that were available.
Yeah, available. Mm-hmm. Early in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only one.
Yeah, well, Hillers but, always seem like they're pretty rickety, though. They, or at least they sounded that way a lot of times.
The Hiller?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it shook and rattled.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of bulletins come out on that. That's what the Forest Service bought, was the Hiller.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bulletins come out, but they finally got the that thing taken care of, and it's turned out to be a good machine.
Mm-hmm.
And, and now they, there's quite a few of them around that they put the Allison turbine engine in them, mm-hmm. a conversion for that. And that makes a terrific machine. They're really a performer mm-hmm. then. See, that Allison, that'll put out 420 horse, but then they have to derate it mm-hmm. because of the rotor transmission and rotor head and stuff like that. But, see, they can go up to 15,000 feet, and they've still got their derated horsepower where it's redlined. See, and still it's still available. Whereas before, as I remember the old rule of the thumb, if you put a load in and setting up in pretty high altitude with the reciprocating engine that was not turbocharged, you could pick up whatever you had in it to a hover. And, first you would look to see when it was shut off where your manifold pressure gauge was setting, if it was setting on 34 or 37, whatever. And then you pick it up to a hover. And if you had 3 inches left, you'd go ahead and go. That was a rule of the thumb that I always used. But if you had less than that, you were asking for trouble, you know. And if you matched them, and then you went ahead and took off, then you probably didn't live to tell about this.
I remember old Slid. We had I can't remember the guy's name. He'd been up in Alaska, a bush pilot or a helicopter. He came in there really a strange guy that came in one day to work on some of the fires. We had a lot of lightning strikes all over the place,
mm-hmm.
and. Slim was down there at the Forest Service building. That thing was just popping and rattling like that. And Slim was supposed to go out with him like that. He had his passport around, walking around. The guy said, "Oh, it's just a Hiller, you know." But he was a character. Yeah, he knew the machine, but boy, it sure. Because he tried to lift me out from up there in Clark Creek, all these real tall screws right up out of the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And I had that little, just a little sack with a camera and I think a jacket in there, and he said, "No, I better leave that."
Yeah.
So, I don't weigh that much, you know. So we just started out there, only about halfway out. I didn't know he could stop with that quick, but he just, you know, shoot the skins to her.
You know, Bob Bjornsson, this was on the Anthony Lake fire, and he was a fire boss on that, you know. And I took him from down at that. Picked him up at the, there's a guard station back in there, and I can't remember, it was on the La Grande District.
Yeah, no, Porcupine, was it?
Porcupine, yeah. That's it. I picked him up there, and he wanted to go up above Anthony Lakes up in there, and that's high back in
there.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, "Bob, if I land there, you're going to have to walk back, because," I said, "I can't get you out. I can land." Well, he said, "I just about got to get in there," so I went in and landed, and he said, "Well, wait around for me for a little bit." And he said, "Maybe you can try to get me out." So I said, "Okay." So I shut down and waited. And he come back in about an hour, and in one try, I just picked it up and tried to keep staying ground effect, picked up some speed, you know, get through transition. Once I come up just a little way, she started settling right back down, and I set it down, and it convinced him. He walked out. He didn't ask me to try it again.
Do you remember the guy that was around the Grand there, Walker? He's a pretty young kid. I think he was co-piloting with Rensick, wasn't he, Ralph?
Oh. No, I know who you mean. I taught him to fly. He's around there. He had an airplane of his own, bought a J-3, and around.
Because I heard he went on and was flying helicopter, I guess, on Montana or someplace.
Well, he, I sent him down to to Evergreen, to Dell Smith, and he worked down there and he got his helicopter rating. And then he went to work for Bill Rosenbaum. He had Bill had bought some of these Canemans. You know, they're the intersecting rotors. There are two rotors in this. They set on a mast side by side, but they slope like this, but they come across each other. They're kind of a funny-looking outfit. He'd gotten them surplus. And then he worked. He had a contract down and out of Tucson there with us someplace. And Darryl was fluent for him down there. And I remember up on the, what they call Lemon Mountain, that's that big mountain there east of Tucson, the game commissioner or somebody, they had some goats up there, and they wanted to keep them on that mountain for some reason or other, but they had this big trough that had, a watering trough's what they wanted, had a spring up there. And they wanted to get that up there, and it was pretty heavy, and I guess they'd had a military a chopper, I don't know just what it was, try to pick it up and sling, you know, and take it up there, and they had to drop it. They couldn't make it, so I heard later that old Walker went in there and they hooked him onto it, and by God, he set it up there for him.
Well, he's kind of crazy.
Oh, he was a daredevil. Yeah.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, he was, boy.
Because I always went out there, we had the, was the 206 Cessna there, and he took off, and he said, well, I took the door off, I thought you might want to take him, you know, take some pictures here. We're going up over Mount Harris. The next thing I know, he's tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, you flying this for a while here? I want to take a look out here. Here we're just going up over the mountain. he was terrible.
Yeah, I remember Ray Zander and him. This was at the airport one afternoon. Ray had fixed up a parachute and they hook a rope on to about 100 or 200 feet of it. And then take a car and start down the runway, and this would bring a chute off, and he, Walker was riding this, see, and he was up about 50, 60 feet in the air. Well, the rope broke, or was the snap, or whatever was hooked to him, and of course he did, the chute wasn't, he'd come down, oh, he hit the ground, boy, he did hit the ground.
Well, I'd heard something about that, I didn't know what the background was.
I figured it had killed him. I went out there and he was just gathering himself up, and you could tell he was hurting. But he did have enough sense of humor about it. He says, well, back to the drawing board. But the last I heard of him, he had a couple of steerings. He was down in Arizona someplace where they grew a lot of cotton down there, and he was spraying and dusting down there. But that's been a long time ago.
Well, I'd heard something about that, where he had that chute out there at the airport.
Yeah. Yeah, Zander rigged that up for him. Well, he'd try anything.
Yeah. Do you remember anything special, any story with Ray at all, Zander? That was experience he had? Or?
He was... Well, I guess I'd say he was the best smoke jumper spotter that I ever worked with, one of the best. And I do recall he'd come up front looking things over when we'd get to a fire where he's picking out the spot and dropping streamers and stuff. And he always batting his eyes and he's chewed to Copenhagen. And he'd look things over and tell you what he decided and what he wanted you to do, and that was it. He went back and we done it. But he was really good. And he was a good, he was a squad leader too. Well, and if you ran there, why, he was the boss of the smoke jumpers, you know. But he was really a proficient guy.
Yeah, I seem to be.
Yeah, I've been.
A little bit I've been around there like that.
Yeah, but we never had any. We had one time that I guess it upset him pretty much. I didn't see it until it come loose. But one guy jumped out. He jumped two at a time. And his chute opened in the static line, and the other one was right behind him, and he was really too close, and he went through his, through the other guy's shroud lines. And there was, I didn't see him until they were both hanging one chute out this way and one out this way, and they were together, just going into the trees. But they didn't hurt either one of them. At one time, this has been a long time ago, back over on the Imanaha, back in there. And this guy's name was Wilson. Yeah, I think he was a ranger or something, a great big guy. He was pretty cranky. And they had a fire back in there, and this is a long time back. Back in the old J3 days and so on, you know. And the wool sacks for parachute, and he had a radio, and he told this guy that was dropping, they dropped a couple of stuff out in the little flat away from the cook tent stuff. It was supplies, and he said, "I don't want to spend a half a day walking after that stuff." He said, "I want it up here where I can get at it." Well, the next drop he got was a sack of spuds right down through the tent and onto the cook table. he got that close enough. He never said anything more.
That shut him up pretty fast. What were you throwing out of, or what plane was it that you're dropping out of?
This was old Larry Solar.
Oh.
That later he was not working for the Forest Service then, but he's flying an old travel air. And later he went to work for the Forest Service, and then that's when the Forest Service bought their Nordines and stuff. And he's the one that pioneered that. I think they got two of them. And at the time, well, I guess Larry, they told him he had his choice. He'd get trimotored Fords or Nordines, whichever one he wanted. And he chose the Nordines. And they used them for quite a few years, you know, and on out of inner city. And they might have had three of them, I don't know. But anyway, they had one out of Cave Junction, too, I know, down on the coast. But then he retired, and then that's when Monty Pierce came into the picture.
Yes, the only other thing was, were you dropping on that, I talked I think on the phone there about on the Minum when Ray was showing those, I was trying to think whether that was the same year as Anthony Lakes. When
it was.
Yeah, at the same time, because we heard that on the radio about mm-hmm. Anthony when they were, when that fire was gone or the fires were burning that night, we could hear him over there in the Minum.
Yeah, well that was... It was Ray and I, and we had dropped these.
Oh, yeah, it's got a little bit.
Okay.
We had dropped these jumpers that morning, and we were back in there dropping them something to eat and some more cargo, mm-hmm. and it was getting pretty late. It was getting dark. By the time I got on down the canyon, further than about the time I come up to the crest of the canyon, east of La Grande, to pull out over the ridge, and that's when we hit this wind. Boy, it was a strong wind. And you could see the lightning, and it was dry lightning all back through that Anthony Lake country. Mm-hmm. And boy, the next morning we got up, we had fires every place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that same fire was when, and this was a couple of 3 days later, back over it again, and we dropped some cargoes or meals, evening meal. And then the guy out of Joseph, Sid Winsor, and the ranger of the Wallawa district, I can't remember his name, was in this 180, and they were going to drop some sleeping bags.
Oh, I remember, yeah.
And but they didn't have their door off or anything, and they were going to shove them through the baggage door. Well, they just sucked them out there and went back, and they caught the horizontal stabilizer, and that's where they hung.
Yeah, went right over the floor.
Well, I heard this voice on the radio calling, "Mayday, Mayday, Mayday." Maybe it was dark, see, because it was dark when we left. And he was circling around there, I guess, waiting for us to get out of there. He come into the ground and landed. And of course, when he slowed down on the runway, while the sleeping bags dropped off, they were laying out there on the runway. But it, he wouldn't have went too much further because it had cracked the front spar in the horizontal stabilizer, and wouldn't have been but just a short time till the other one went, and he lost half of it. Had to have been it. But that was a pretty foolish trick.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that ranger, I think old Carey, I believe he was there then, but he really caught it. He's going to lose his job for it.
Because that's what I was saying, you know, we're right up, I can't remember exactly where all the mine are there, but we're right up real high there, and I'm sure that was Ray that was dropping the cargo, because we dropped the water cans, and I know one went right out through the burlap sack, and it down there,
mm-hmm.
And I was going down and collect the water out of it, and that's when it made that second pass of that box of little fruit juice cans.
It broke that. Well, for some reason, we had some problems of chute malfunctions there. That was on that fire that sheep camp started.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty high up there.
Oh, yeah, that was mm-hmm. way up on top of that ridge.
Yeah, it was up Bear Creek, and then but it was on top from Bear Creek.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is
yeah, you're up. Right up, you know, sitting about as high as elevation mm-hmm. as that whole level in there.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's what I'm talking about, those guys that needed their coffee, that chute came in and it went right out. I think it was a 5 gallon can of coffee. It went right out through the burlap sack. Or no, the chute only half open. That was it. Because it took a top out of an alpine fir about that big. Just mashed it. Took the whole top out. These guys down there wringing the coffee out of the burlap sack. I said, that was a classic, that whole thing. These guys, one guy said they're shaking head to have his coffee. And God, I'd love to have a movie on that. It would just been it's one of a kind.
Whoever packed those chutes ever was doing something. It wasn't, because that's about the only trouble. You'd have an occasional streamer.
Oh, yeah.
But just to have one after another like that, there was something wrong with it. But one time, this was over on the Umatilla, and I was getting the cargo was being packaged there at the warehouse in Pelton. And I was picking it up there and taking it out back down in there toward on the Grand Round River back in that area. And that was the worst mess, but that wasn't chutes. The chutes were open. They weren't packing them, but it was the way they strapped the package to cargo. And I remember I had watermelons, about 4 crates of them, you know, a pretty good sized crates. And threw them out and it just jerked the chute. They didn't have it secured right, wasn't packed right. Jerked it right out, and of course the crate free fell, hit the hillside, and of course watermelon pieces went all over. Well, those guys were really, really put out. They didn't have any supper that evening. They were everything was busted. Nothing got to the ground, and so then they says, "Well, the cargo went out of the Grand, and forget about." Because the people over there that were doing it didn't know how to do it, see? And
Now, because I know we had, I was trying to think, well, because there's ham in there, and they have, there's some gravy and like it, but the heavy stuff was packed on top, and it went right down through, you know what it hit. All the stuff, the heavy stuff, went right down through it. I remember this Andy Anderson, the coach there at school, he's taking, and here everybody going, their hands are just black from fighting fire. He's out there with his ham slices just going like decks of cards on everybody's plate. And one guy came back, because they dropped some ice cream too. I don't contain ice cream, so it's real cheap. One guy came back and said, well, you can have my ice cream lot. I thought, well, maybe. Don't know why I didn't want ice cream. Went over here, this guy with a big black sweaty hat. He just, hey, we didn't have any utensil. He just take like put the scoops on the there for his plate. Oh, it was terrible. But there's no organization. There's, I think, about three rangers like that. But everybody, when the food come in, everybody is just like a bunch of barbarians. You know, just grabbing stuff. One guy, I remember, he had a whole plate like this. He's reaching for something else, and somebody else ate everything off his plate on his. I said, if we could have had a movie of that, it was just one thing. It was just a classic.
You know, that's really too bad, because those guys have worked like the devil down there, and I knew they were hungry.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then to have that stuff break up like that.
Yeah.
That wasn't a morale builder, I'll tell you for sure.
Well, worst we ever got on that Silver Creek fire out of Lost Dean. First of all, well, we started out about 11 at night. We left the ranger station, and he sent us the wrong way. We were clear up south of the fire there. I think, good grief, it must have been at least a couple miles. Because when we came up over the ridge, it's just a little glow to the north. We're that far away from that fire, as big as that thing was. We hiked all night out that ridge, and it was real spooky because there's all those bluffs are in there.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And we're just like a bunch of ants running all over the flashlights there. Mm-hmm. You only had a couple of flashlights, mm-hmm. Not everybody had them. And I remember old Don Shaw, I don't know if you ever knew Don or not, but he had that one polio arm where he was crippled. And this one guy slipped, and he was sliding down right out over one of these bluffs, and Don ran down there and just grabbed the shovel and what little dirt there was or rocks and stopped him, just went over the guy. He actually thought he died because he got clear back, and some took him back to pick up before he actually come to realize that he's still living. And the next morning we got out there, we're sitting right up on this thing, it looked like an eagle's perch. I remember carrying these guys with a helicopter, come flying by. Who are those guys and how in the world they got there? Because we're still a big canyon across from the fire itself. So they dropped some food in there, and they carried this stuff. Here's all these sandwiches and oranges, candy bars. Mm-hmm. And somebody packed aviation fuel in with all this stuff. Everything was just saturated with the gas. And we're sitting there just starved to death, eat this stuff. Oh, no, all that gas was belching up. It was about 5 a.m. before we finally got to the fire the next day. And, who's the engineer? I could have killed him. Because he's sitting there giving me a bad time about being late to come to the fire. And I was about strangling after all we had to go through. Oh, it was terrible. No, it was real classic.
I wonder what ever become of Livingston there that used to be the ranger at Union.
He died.
Did he?
He had cancer here.
Oh.
It must be about 10 years ago.
Flynn was telling us about it.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. I guess I forgot.
I didn't. I hadn't heard about it, even though I lived right there. Then I think a year and a half, something like that, before I even found out about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, it seems like we always.
I guess he took up scuba diving, and he was out with his daughter, according to what she said. Mm-hmm. And they were scuba diving, and Ray went down wherever it was, and. He just didn't come back up.
Mm-hmm.
They figured he had a heart attack or something.
Yeah, because I didn't. I was talking to Lee Walton here this summer, as he mentioned, because I mentioned about Ray, and I hadn't heard anything about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think you went down to Arizona, wasn't it?
He had retired, but he was living down around Detroit.
Oh, Oregon. Is that where it was?
Yeah, that's where it was. In there someplace in the Cascades.
Mm-hmm. Because just I kind of lose track of it a lot of times where people disappear to you and like that.
He was a nice guy.
Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, he sure was. Neil, you know, his brother, I imagine he's retired now, but he was a fire control officer up there on one of those districts.
Pomeroy, wasn't it?
Pomeroy, yeah. It was on the Umatilla force, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he had a bad one, too. She was telling me that his boy, I don't know, he was 15, 16 years old, he wrecked the motorcycle and killed himself. So.
Yeah.
I remember one of them good.
Remember
zucchini.
Oh.
Made out of zucchini.
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 Oh, zucchini. The bathtub.
I got the mouth.
Oh,
yeah. Those are really good. Is that from the garden out here?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, I make a bunch of those cupcakes, and then when little kids come, stick them in the microwave. They just love them.
Oh, yeah.
And they're good for you, and they freeze just real good.
You plant one zucchini plant, just one, and we give squirrels. And I had a fabric tester. They're a deal about so long with a real sharp needle on them, and then they keep getting thicker as you go back, and then a meter on it, and it depends on how much pressure pounds and to check the fabric. So he come up one day and he wanted me to take that thing down there. It was an expensive darn thing, even though it wasn't very big. And I put it up to the side of the fuselage like this, had it in my hand, and was kind of using my knee, you know, to move it as evenly as I could. Poke a hole in the fabric. It was rotten.
But he flew it
that way.
Well, I don't know how guy had to have a charmed life, I think. For all he went through like that.
Yeah.
Just,
he come out there one time in the wintertime and the fog was moving in and you could see it coming up the valley, you know. It was just a breeze and it was just moving it in. And he was going to go flying, and I told him, I said, Darryl, you're going to get, it'll fog in and you won't get back. Oh, no, he said, I'll slip in there. So he goes out, gets his airplane, and goes out flying, and he comes back, and it had moved in. But there was a little bit of the end of the runway, I guess. It wasn't fogged in. So he landed on that, but he was still going pretty fast. And I heard the tires screeching and in the fog, and he didn't know which way he was going. And then pretty quick I heard a thump. He ground looped and stuck a wing in the ground. Pretty quick here he came up, taxiing in. He'd had his wing tip all dinged up. Just grinning from ear to ear, you know.
Well, got down okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's the first time I flew with him on that spotty. You know, he gives a real good feeling. When he started out, he didn't even know how to start the thing. He didn't read the instruction book without how to start that. Just popping like that. He tore that door off and left the seat in, which I never liked in there, you know, compared to being on the floor.
Yeah.
And we're just taking up over the, going again out towards Indian Creek, up over Mount Harris there. Yeah. And I went to fasten the seatbelt, and the whole thing went right out the door. Nobody fastened into the floor.
No.
So I'm sitting here on top of the seat, you know, right next to the whole door off my fist. I just didn't give you a good feeling whatsoever.
Well, I'll tell you, I would even got in the airplane if you were in the operating.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was wondering. You know, that's the first time I've flown with them. I said, what am I doing here? Because that time too, you know, he sits there and he's tapped me on the shoulder, and then nobody in the, you know, up there in the pilot seat at all. You know, he's back there, hey, go fly this thing. I want to look out the back door here. Just we're going up over the hill.
Oh.
Yeah. He's one of the guys.
I think he's got a cat lead. I think he's got more than 9 miles.
We have to, I think. You know, for the thing, you know, you're like, well, like with that parachute thing, you know, you know, high up
terrible.
And you bounce off.
Yeah, one, that Chambers, it was in the mechanic that worked for me. Well, he was kind of a daredevil too, but he told old Walker, he said, I bet you can't make either two or three complete loops, or spin turns from 1,000 feet above the ground, and come out of it. So Red Myler had came up from Portland for some reason. Anyway, him and I had went into Le Grand and had a sandwich. We was coming back out the highway, and we seen this yellow cub going to a spin. And Red said, "Geez, God, he's pretty low to be spinning." He said, "I wonder who that is." And I said, "Well, I know who it is." And I said, "When I get out there, I'm going to have a talk with that young man." He was still going down, went behind the outside of the hangar from where we were in the highway. See, and I figured that was the end of Daryl. Yeah. Pretty quick, here it comes. Oh, Red, he just is shaking his head. He said, "Hey, you better have a real big talk with that guy."
Oh, yeah, like you said, I'm a high river with the log, isn't
it? And one time we were going into Le Grand in the car one evening, and Daryl had a motorcycle. Well, he passed us. Then he slowed up and we passed him. And pretty quick, here he comes. He's standing up in the seat. And he passes us, see?
No more?
No, I don't want
to. Do a whole book or movie just out of the life of Daryl Walker.
Yeah, and those parachutes, you know, that old parachute he had, you know, he jumped a lot. And anybody that take him up, he'd jump. Well, that took too long to pack that thing if there was another chance to go up to jump. Why, he didn't take the time to put it out on the packing table and pack it. He just wadded it up under his arm and said, "Get back in the airplane and go again."
Go back up.
And it had holes in it. I wouldn't have trusted you. I don't know where he got that.
Is that the one Vander put the bottle in and smoke? Who done that?
Oh, I think Ralph Rensick did that to him. He had it packed that time, but when he opened it, well, here come all these tomato cans.
A bottle.
Bottles. And they're all just like this.
Yeah. Now that's a real crew.
We had a lot of fun out there.
But you was asking me about Ralph Rensick. The only thing I was thinking afterwards, if you're ever over around Lewiston, look up Jerry Wilson. You knew him, didn't you?
Remember the name? I was trying.
Well, he's the one that I sold out to.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
At Hillcrest there, but he's got a. Yeah. Don't call it Hillcrest anymore, but he's got a. He got an airplane that's kind of, the hangars are out there kind of in the center of the field. And he's the vice president or the president of some bank over there now. Mm-hmm. I know he's flying. But he's the only one I can think of that might know the whereabouts of Ralph. But I know he isn't flying anymore. But if you're ever through there, you might just have a little extra time.
I got to think, because I know I've got some shots of him dropping back in on the mine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, some of that.
But he'd do. Jerry is the only one I could think of, because he worked for Jerry C. quite a long time before ever I sold out to him. He flew spray planes and stuff like that for him. One time up at St. Mary's, they were circulating, they were putting on parathion. And you know, that stuff's real dangerous. I mean, it's poison, real poison. And they were circulating this stuff, and they had it running through a kind of a vat, and around and through a hose. And no, Ralph, he thought that hose was fresh water. He goes over there picks it up, takes a couple of swallows of it. He damn near died.
Well, yes.
God almighty. He was sick all summer.
Oh, I bet. Those guys, they have a charmed life.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah, he's quite a realm.
Yeah, I remember that one summer. They didn't, you know, they're all sitting around. There wasn't any fire at all that summer. I think Darryl was in with them there, and they're in there.
That's when Rosenbaum had the contract there, probably, mm-hmm. huh? That's when.
Had the, yeah. Had those two there, what, light night oxygen, making little bombs and all, you know,
like. Oh, yeah, he was.
Like guns.
Good stuff.
Just
like that.
To keep them occupied during the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember one time, a long time ago, Slim, I took the three of them into the horse ranch. There's a little fire going up the river there, and so they'd sent Slim and two other guys in there, and I flew them into the horse ranch, and then they were going to get horses and ride up to the fire. Old Red, you know, he kind of went on the old cuss.
Oh, yeah.
He gave old Slim a horse. Slim got on the horse and he's ready to go, and right away he got off with the radio. He goes, Slim says, "You red-headed son of a bitch, I'll kill you."
Right, so they're just laughing like
yeah.
that.
Tickled the hell out of me, sir. But he was in order to do things like that. I was up there elk hunting, Norm Dennis and I, one time, and up at his upper camp. And these two or three dudes that he had in there, which, you know, he had to, he put up with a lot of crap from people like that, you know. They'd just really give him hell because they think that there should be one tied up for him and they don't get one. And he was at the supper table, he was belly aching about damned old crow bait horses he's got. He said, "You can't get him to move." And he was really complaining. So the next morning, while Red put him on one, it was cold, God, it was in November, and it was a cold, cold morning, snow on the ground. It threw that guy off right about the middle of my river when he wanted to go across, you know. He never said no more about the horses.
About that little horse. Oh, yeah, because old Red, you know, anything like that, it just tickled him to death.
Yeah, he... But he just, he wouldn't pay his help anything, you know. And so he'd have one cook leaving Portland. The guy that the employment service he went to, he got his clientele to place him, you know, as her employment service off of Skid Row. And there'd be one cook leaving Portland, one cooking, one leaving the horse ranch, and back and forth, you know, they wouldn't last very long, you know.
Well, I come in there one time, working on survey back in there, and had a horse, and it just really got nasty, been out like all week, so I thought, well, I'll come down there and just stay at the horse ranch one night. So the Azra, you know, how much he charged, I think $6 to do it, and got just a little bit of oats for the horse there, and ended up the cook was gone, so I'm sitting there cooking, doing the dishes and everything else, you know. Because that time, I guess one guy was coming in, you know, the other one already got mad and left.
Oh, geez. That guy, I tell you, he get mad at them cooks. Up at the horse ranch, or up at the upper camp, I don't know whether that was the same time the guy got bucked off the horse, it could have been. But that one night it snowed about a foot and a half of wet snow. And the cook tent just collapsed, went in. And so the next morning, why, here come this cook. He'd get up earlier, see, and he'd go in. Well, his tent was all smashed down. So he wakes up red. We were in the same tent, big tent, five or six of us in there, sleeping bags, and red, the cook tent fell down. Well, we'll see if we can't get it put back up. Well, they did. But then he had another bad habit. The hunters would come in, you know, and they'd be break out their bottles and be sitting there drinking and drying out, resting. And he'd stick his head in the tent door and he'd say, "Fellas, supper will be ready in about an hour." "Well, fine, here, have a drink." So he takes a drink and then he goes to the next one and makes the rounds. And then he'd come back. "About 45 minutes, fellas, we'll be ready to eat." Another drink, you know. So this one evening, he got too many rounds and he was laying on the cook table asleep. Red came in and Red was wet and cold and tired. And after dark, not even a fire bill in the cook stove. Oh, he just beat the hell out of that poor damn cook. His eyes was black the next morning and he was going to leave. All he had on was a pair of those little old sandals with straps around the toes. And the snow was about that deep, see, it's elk season up there. Red says, "Yeah, so and so." He says, "You can quit if you want to, but," he says, "you don't get no horse." He says, "You walk." The guy could be.
Yeah, the guy could have just had video, you know, his camcorder or something like that, or movie back there, got all that.
Oh,
just,
God, I wish
to... You couldn't stand to watch
no.
all
that.
I wish they had video cameras in.
Yeah.
Like then, one time I took in a load of groceries in there, and he'd buy mayonnaise in his gallon jar.